very impressed that you brave the cold and come in a very, very respectable numbers here today. I am Michael Yehuda. I'm associated with the center, and because the director Ed McCord can't be here, he's asked me to represent him, which I'm very happy to do. We have three distinguished people to address us, and in particular I'd like to welcome Scott Bates, who has produced a very interesting and challenging paper which he will present to you, and then we have two commentators. Scott Bates has served in leadership roles in the state, national and international levels in policy development and government for over 20 years. He has experience on Capitol Hill, including serving as chief of staff for Congressman Nick Lamson and counsel to Congressman Jim Turner. After September the 11th, he became the first senior policy advisor to the U.S. House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee, and was the principal author of Winning the War on Terror, which helped inform the 9/11 Commission in its deliberations and development of its report. Bates taught Homeland Security at the National Defense University here in Washington. He's been a visiting professor of international law and international human rights law at the University of Indiana School of Law, and he's been visiting professor of government at Connecticut College. He holds a JD from the University of Virginia School of Law, an MSc in International Relations from London School of Economics, and he tells me that I was then one of his teachers, so it proves once again how former students can excel and go beyond, far beyond the sight of their original teachers. He graduated magna cum laude in history and political science from the University of Dayton. So, as you can see, he's a person of considerable experience both in policy making and in academia, and he's been involved in both law and international relations, which I think pertain greatly to the whole issue of Taiwan, and where we should all benefit from that. As the commentators, the first is Joseph Bosco. He has served in the office of the Secretary of Defense as China Country Desk Officer from 2005 to 2006, and as Director of Asia-Pacific Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief from 2008 to 2010. He has represented the OSD at conferences in Beijing, Canberra, and Bandar Aceh. He previously taught a graduate seminar on China-Taiwan-U.S. relations in the Asian Studies program at Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and has organized several conferences on U.S. policy on China-Taiwan relations, addressing such issues as the One China policy, strategic ambiguity, engagement and deterrence in East Asia. He was a non-resident senior fellow in the Asia-Pacific program at the Atlantic Council and was a member of the Council's delegation to observe Taiwan's 2000 presidential election. As a private consultant, he has been invited to address conferences in many places, including in Shanghai, on U.S.-China relations. In December, only last month, he moderated a panel on East Asian security at the Japan-Taiwan-U.S. Trilateral Conference on Trilateral Economic and Security Cooperation in Taipei. Mr. Bosco is a non-resident senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has served as communications officer in the U.S. Navy in the Western Pacific. He received an AB degree from Harvard College and his LLB from Harvard Law School, his LLM from Georgetown Law Center. As I'm sure many of you will come across his articles in newspapers here, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, and so on. Next to him, and the second commentator, is Mr. Richard Fisher. He's a senior fellow with the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He has previously served as a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, editor of the Jamestown Foundation China Brief, senior fellow with the House Republican Policy Committee, and director of the Asian Studies Center of the Heritage Foundation. He is the author of China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach, which was published first by Praeger and then Stanford University. He's contributed the chapter on foreign influences in China's future submarine force. His articles have been published in Jane's International Review, Jane's Defense Weekly, Defense Technology International, Aviation Week, and so on. So we have very knowledgeable and distinguished commentators, as well as a person who has not only got the academic and policy credentials, but has been someone who has been active on Capitol Hill, and he is now the president of the Center for National Policy, which is one of the leading institutes in Washington that provides policy advice both to administrations and within Congress. So, without further ado, let me pass on to Scott Davis.
Thank you very much, Doctor. And it's great to be with all of you here today. I think I should extend my thanks to GW, of course, and to Dr. McCord, but in particular to Michael Yehuda, because this story I have not told, which is that when I was an aspiring graduate student, I had a choice. I could either go to the London School of Economics or GW Elliott School. True story. And I got a good offer from here, but I thought, you know, I'll probably spend a good part of my life in Washington, D.C., and I had seen the professors at LSE had. Michael Yehuda was, in fact, my advisor when I arrived fresh-faced from the United States. So this is a real thrill to be reunited with you, sir, and to be here at this great institution. And I hope you're all enjoying your course of studies. And if you chose this over LSE, I'm sure you made the right choice. I made the right choice for me at that time. I'm also very excited and happy to be with my two colleagues here, Mr. Fisher and Joe Bosco. And I'm very interested in hearing their thoughts on what really is a true strategic dilemma for Taiwan, which fits into how are we going to build a sustainable security architecture for the Asia Pacific in the 21st century. Europe has a security architecture, East Asia does not, in a formal sense. And with the rise of China, how can we ensure that forces in Beijing that are positive and productive are encouraged, and those that are not transparent, such as the People's Liberation Army and others, some of them may be positive and productive, some may not. We want to encourage there to be stability in the Asia-Pacific region. Here's the problem as I see it with Taiwan. Since 1979, Taiwan has been losing ground slowly but surely in a strategic sense vis-a-vis the People's Republic of China. You can judge this by the diplomatic recognition, you can judge it now, certainly by economic statistics, and you can now judge it by the force structures on both sides of the Taiwan Straits. Why is this important? Do I believe that there's going to be some kind of attack tomorrow against Taiwan? No, I don't see it. It's not in Beijing's interests at this time. However, we all know the calculation is much more subtle. Relationships are built on perception in international relations, and the rise of the PRC has shifted relationships throughout the region. And so if the people of Taiwan want to determine their own future outside of pressure in a diplomatic or military sense from the mainland, then I humbly suggest that they've got to break out of this strategic decline that has been going on for the past 30 years. I posed several thoughts on this, and the intention was to be provocative, but also to say that there may be other ways to look at how to do this. But the current situation reminds one of the fable of the frog in slowly boiling water. And that is Taiwan's situation. To believe that tomorrow will be much like today, and today is much like yesterday, is just not going to hold. And you can look at the scales tipping. A corollary to that, 7 years ago I was in Taiwan and had meetings with a lot of national security experts, and I posed the question, how long could you hold out in a crisis? We don't worry about that because you'll be there to help us. There's something unsaid in the relationship that the U.S. would be there. The U.S. has its own interests. Let's be very clear. And if Taiwan is not prepared to add to the calculus in a positive way, then the decision making in Washington may be different in a time of crisis. And that's why I say Taiwan has to do all it can to ensure that its defenses are strong and sound and provide a real deterrent so that there never will be a crisis in the Taiwan Strait and that everyone can live in peace and harmony in years to come. But think about it. What is the potential flashpoint in that region between the U.S. and the PRC? And you have to say that Taiwan is in that zone of probability. So what were a couple of the ideas and what my thinking behind it? You might have seen I did an article about this in the Taipei Times. And here are some of the, here's the premise. That Taiwan adopt a defense strategy much like the PLA is adopting vis-a-vis the United States. Access area denial. Make the cost of intervention too high to consider. And align your systems accordingly. Currently, Taiwan has about 1,100 tanks. My question would be why? Are you expecting a kind of, you know, seaborne invasion, Normandy type, and you're going to repel them at the beaches? Is that really the way that pressure is going to be exerted? Or might it be in a different fashion? I would suggest that, especially taking into account the defense spending in the past 10 years in particular, where the PRC spending has been at a rate of increase of about 10-12% every year, and Taipei's has been steady at about 2-3% of GDP. And in absolute terms, the gap is growing greater and greater. So resources equal capabilities, and Taipei's capabilities in terms of defense are much diminished vis-a-vis the PLA than they were 10 and 15 years ago, and the trend continues. Then hard choices have to be made. You cannot do everything. You cannot do everything well. The United States knows this. We're facing the very same question right now. And we've had an army sized for deployments for the past 10 years all through the world, and we're not able to afford the structure that we have. And I think what you're going to see is a realignment to air-sea battle and air-sea capabilities over land. I would suggest the same for Taipei. To try to match rocket for rocket, tank for tank, you can do it if you're going to have 5 or 6% GDP spent in Taiwan on defense. Probably not a wise idea. So that's the military piece of my recommendations, is to shift to air-sea and turn the land force, you know, cut there. And turn it into, there's different ways you could approach it. My original conception was turn it into a humanitarian aid operation on a massive scale. Some countries wouldn't accept it, but let's say there's an Indonesia type situation. What if the ROC were able to be there first on the ground, or at least second, first amongst Asian powers, and offer assistance? All to the political point that Taiwan needs to build relationships and have friends and not just be going around, please recognize us diplomatically. That game is done. It has to be a different set of calculations. So that's on the land force. But I should mention a colleague of mine, Mike Breen, who is a captain in the U.S. Army, and he's executive director at the Truman National Security Project. He has an idea that I think I can share with you. And I took a couple Army captains over to Taiwan just last month, and we had discussions at their NDU. Mike's conception is that you would turn the land force into one that would really, again, be an asymmetric force, anti-tank weapons instead of actual tanks. This would make sense. to make the calculation in Beijing B that it would be exceedingly difficult to take ground and almost impossible to hold it if they ever tried to invade. So a radical reconfiguration of the land forces, I think, is in order. And secondly, and this got some things stirred up in Taipei, I said there should be a pledge to never attack the mainland as policy, even if provoked. And some would say that that's some kind of unilateral disarmament. Quite the opposite, because we all know that politics is always part and parcel of any conflict. And again, thinking the unthinkable, if there were some kind of showdown in the Taiwan Straits, Taiwan needs to have friends and allies in the international community, and Beijing would need to lose face. They would need to know that in any calculation in a crisis, they would be humiliated and embarrassed and would never attempt such an attack in the first place. How could that happen? Imagine the rocket force on the PRC side and some airfields are hit, some bases are hit in Taiwan. Taiwan says, we reiterate our pledge, we will not fire against our friends and brothers on the mainland. And again they're hit, and Taiwan stands on principle. You can imagine the way world opinion would go. This does count, this does matter in a crisis. What would it benefit Taiwan to exchange missile fire and then run out of missiles because the PRC has even more? And then it would be seen as a squabble between distant Asian powers. It needs to be a different dynamic in the calculation of planners in Beijing. They need to believe that a confrontation must never occur. This was my thinking, humbly submitted to all of you, to start a conversation and hopefully get some thinking on breaking out of this strategic dilemma going. So I look forward to hearing from my colleagues and to taking your questions as well.
Thank you, Michael, for the introduction, and to Ed and the Seeger Center for the invitation. It's a delight to be here to address Scott's provocative proposal. He intended to be provocative, and it is, and also with Rick Fisher, who's an acknowledged expert on both Taiwan's military and China's military. This is a little bit awkward for me because I consider Scott a friend, and he was gracious enough to invite me to be a guest speaker at the Center for National Policy. So I find myself in the position of expressing some strong but respectful disagreements with the proposal, and Scott knows it's not on a personal basis. His article, and by the way, my remarks were prepared before I came here based on the article I read, and not necessarily what Scott would say today, which may or may not be a softening of the position in the article. His article opens by correctly stating that since 1979, the Republic of China has been in a perilous strategic position, and that its ability to resist pressure from China's rising economic and military power has eroded year after year. It proposes a bold strategic initiative that will ensure the security and stability of Taiwan as well as the region. Regretfully, however, in my view, the proposal will surely not do that and would actually make Taiwan's security situation worse. The proposal remarkably claims that for the first time in decades, the strategic initiative in the region belongs to Taipei. But it is unclear how that can be the case if Taiwan's strategic position vis-a-vis China has been eroding for three decades. The proposal states that all the actions required to increase security and stability for the nation as well as the region are in the hands of the Taiwanese. That sweeping assertion, seems to me, ignores both history and current reality. We need to ask, why is it that Taiwan's predicament has become more dangerous since 1979? The answer is fairly obvious. That is the year President Jimmy Carter unilaterally switched diplomatic recognition from the Republic of China to the People's Republic of China under the so-called One China Principle. And that is the year he unilaterally terminated the 1954 Mutual Defense Treaty between the United States and Taiwan. The U.S., which was not mentioned in the article, was and remains the ultimate guarantor of Taiwan's continued security and viability as a democratic nation. in fairness to Jimmy Carter, he simply carried out what President Nixon and Henry Kissinger had planned to do in Nixon's second term after a decent interval, until the Watergate scandal intervened. In any event, Congress was outraged by Carter's precipitous unilateral action. It quickly passed the Taiwan's Relations Act, which stated America's strategic interest in preserving the security and the social and economic system of the people of Taiwan. The TRA committed the U.S. to provide Taiwan with the weapons systems necessary to defend itself against the Chinese attack. And that was before 30 years of Chinese military buildup. How could Taiwan possibly stand alone today against Chinese aggression? This proposal seems to suggest that Taiwan should reject even the incomplete American defense commitment embodied in the TRA. As President Ma Ying-jeou recently stated, even with improving cross-strait ties, it is important that Taiwan-U.S. relations continue advancing on security cooperation and many other aspects. America's commitment to Taiwan could be endangered if Washington perceived a weakening of Taiwan's commitment to its own self-defense as envisioned by parts of this proposal. As Scott and Rick and Michael well know, I've often advocated that Washington should move instead in exactly the opposite direction. That is, I believe we should abandon the ill-advised doctrine of strategic ambiguity, whereby we won't explicitly state that we will defend Taiwan against the Chinese attack. That ambiguity has invited China to prepare for such an attack and to develop area denial and anti-access capabilities to deter or defeat a U.S. effort to assist Taiwan. Chinese officials even put that question directly to their American counterparts in the 1995-1996 Taiwan Strait missile crisis. They asked the U.S. officials, what would America do if China attacked Taiwan? The response was, we don't know and you don't know. It would depend on the circumstances. That is the kind of muddled message that led to the North Korean and Chinese miscalculation resulting in the Korean War some 60 years ago. As Kissinger has written, we didn't expect the invasion, and China didn't expect our response. The world does not need a new U.S. Sino war triggered by a strategic mistake across the Taiwan Strait. Mr. Bates' proposal would weaken deterrence even further, advocating that Taiwan, quote, make a solemn pledge that in the event of hostilities, the ROC will never conduct any military action on the shores of China, even if attacked by the Chinese, and that Taiwan should show its benign intentions toward China by eliminating all surface-to-surface missiles held by the ROC. With all due respect, I believe this is a call for partial unilateral disarmament by Taiwan. It would be one thing to ask Taiwan to commit never to initiate an unprovoked attack upon China, such as Chiang Kai-shek's threats back in the 1950s and 60s to retake the mainland. But those threats in those days are gone forever. No government on Taiwan, no matter how committed to either non-communist unification or independence, could ever seriously contemplate launching an attack on China out of the blue. It is quite another matter, however, to suggest that a country already under attack, whose very existence is being threatened, should unilaterally commit itself not to strike back at the aggressor. Such an idea violates every principle of deterrence, a concept that has probably prevented scores of wars over the last century or more. Telling an enemy, which is what China would be if it attacked Taiwan, that the only thing it will lose by committing aggression might be the weapons and personnel it threw into the battle. That simply invites such an attack. Instead, the aggressor should have to worry that it will lose something it values highly, like military bases, or industrial infrastructure, or transportation systems, or energy supplies. Yet this proposal would tell China those targets would be immune from retaliation, even as it was in the process of destroying such assets in Taiwan. It is an astonishing notion given the 1,600 missiles Taiwan presently has targeting Taiwan. China has targeting Taiwan. And the fact that it has already fired missiles toward Taiwan in 1995 and 1996. China needs to understand that actual war is a two-way street, not a free ride without unacceptable consequences. Actually, in Taiwan's case, it would be a three-way war, since for all its stated ambiguity, the U.S. would not stand aside and allow Taiwan to be taken over by force of arms. The proposal not only calls for unilateral disarmament of Taiwan's deterrent capability, it also advocates completely eliminating Taiwan's ground defenses against an amphibious invasion or airborne ground assault. First, it would cut the army in half. Then, ironically, it would label the shell that is left as a so-called self-defense force, except that its mission would not be self-defense at all. In the words of the proposal, it would shift from trying to resist a land invasion to providing disaster relief. In other words, Taiwan's army would respond to a natural disaster from wind, rain, and waves coming in from the sea, but not against a man-made disaster from a flood of Chinese soldiers, sailors, and airmen, and Marines. I'm not sure the people of Taiwan would believe their security was being properly protected under such a scheme. The proposal says Taiwan would then be in a position to be Asia's premier defense disaster response team. Having spent a few years working on disaster relief in the Defense Department, I can say that the practical, economic, and political complications of this idea are too numerous to discuss here. In addition to abandoning deterrence and ground defense, the proposal calls for political surrender of Taiwan's claims for self-determination and full membership in the international community. As a substitute for diplomatic recognition, it says Taiwan should seek solutions to the South China Sea disputes. But those issues are not mutually exclusive. Working for peaceful resolution of those maritime claims does not require that Taiwan give up its legitimate, long-term aspiration and need for the international respect that can only come from formal diplomatic recognition. On the contrary, taking a responsible position, responsible leadership role in the South China Sea can enhance Taiwan's standing in the world as a model of peaceful resolution of disputes. That's exactly the position laid out in the Taipei Times article that's available in the back of the room, and it's an item that we did discuss with President Mao when our delegation met with him about a month ago. The last two elements of Mr. Bates' proposal are not inherently objectionable, but are either redundant or have some practical problems. It suggests that Taiwan conduct a democracy offensive across Asia by funding community organizations and social media against, quote, governments that systematically deny their citizens fundamental rights. The largest and most powerful of those human rights violators, of course, is the People's Republic of China, which might not exactly welcome such efforts by Taiwan. There is a need to press Beijing on human rights and political reform, and Taiwan should speak out as appropriate. But the pressure should come primarily from the United States and the broader international community. Taiwan has already done its part by freeing itself from an authoritarian past and emerging as a vibrant democracy in its own right, disproving the myth perpetuated by Beijing and many Western scholars that a Confucian society cannot function as a democracy. President Ma has frequently criticized China's repression of human rights activists. He has called on China to follow Taiwan's model and move toward political reform before unification could ever be a serious possibility. Former Vice President Annette Liu was instrumental in organizing the Democratic Pacific Assembly, a conference of the democratic countries of the Asia-Pacific region, with the goal of establishing a democratic Pacific Union to advance the cause of political freedom in the region. As a practical matter, tiny Taiwan can push its big, threatening neighbor only so far toward democracy, except by setting a good example through its own democratic governance. The more powerful players on the world stage can do a lot more, and they should. Moral pressure on the Soviet Union played a large part in its demise, and that is what is needed to encourage political reform in China today. As for the last recommendation that Taiwan acquire every conceivable weapon system on its wish list, that would be wonderful. A, if Taiwan could afford to buy them, and B, if the U.S. and other countries would sell them to Taiwan over China's objections. So far, neither condition has been met on many, if not most, of the major items Taiwan has requested. The underlying premise of the entire proposal seems to be that Taiwan somehow lacks moral legitimacy in the eyes of the international community. It asserts, quote, "Taiwan's pledge to never attack China in any instance would give Taipei the moral high ground in any confrontation and have the immediate effect of exposing the current military buildup across the Taiwan Strait as an aggressive act," unquote. But Taiwan already has the moral high ground as a democratic, peaceful, and responsible society. There is not a government in the world that believes Taiwan would commit an act of aggression against China. Taiwan, in contrast to China, has shown itself as a responsible citizen in a number of ways. During the pandemics of avian flu, AIDS, H1N1, and SARS, Taiwan was among the leaders in sharing critical information with the international community. China, on the other hand, held back vital data and refused to cooperate with World Health officials. When Japan was struck with the earthquake and tsunami, Taiwan was the world's leading contributor, far surpassing China's meager donation, despite the huge disparity in wealth. Taiwan has been an effective and active participant in the Proliferation Security Initiative, PSI, halting an illegal shipment of weapons by North Korea. China, on the other hand, refuses to join the 100 other countries of PSI, and in fact has assisted North Korea in its proliferation of nuclear and missile technology. On issue after issue, Taiwan has demonstrated its moral superiority to China's authoritarian government. It did so again most recently through its democratic election after a vigorous two-party campaign, whereas in China, 25 men on the Standing Committee of the Communist Party selected that country's new leaders for the next decade. While the Communist Party has ruled China for 60 years without the consent of the Chinese people, since the 1990s, Taiwan has conducted 5 presidential and scores of local and regional elections, with multiple parties competing peacefully for the decision of the people. Considering that record, I feel confident in concluding, contrary to the apparent theme of the proposal, that Taiwan does not need to disarm unilaterally in order to prove its moral or political legitimacy. I look forward to your questions and comments.
I too would like to thank Michael and Cord, Sugar Center, for inviting me here to speak to a very distinguished audience that has come in from the cold. I would like to thank the Center for the invitation to share this podium with two very distinguished public servants. What I'd like to do is start with some big picture comments about the Chinese challenge, assess Scott's proposal from its encouraging aspects and the aspects with which I would disagree. In many respects, I would maybe repeating some of Joe's comments.
Continue.
Is this an alarm or
that's right.
It's a fire alarm back here.
There is a fire emergency reported in the building.
Did you do that? After you put the knife in me and then you pull the fire alarm, you son of a gun.
Hopefully we can continue this when we return.
You know.
I thank you.
You're up.